Hey listeners, Lex on the Decks here. Before you get stuck into this episode of Hot Girls, I wanted to let you know about something else you may be interested in. Though Hot Girls in its podcast format isn't releasing new episodes any longer, if you head over to my Substack, which is lexonthedecks.substack.com, you'll find more interviews and insight on gender minority artists and how to overcome any barriers to entry. You'll also get the opportunity to sign up to my weekly newsletter, 5 Good Things. This is an email letter which will land in your inbox on Fridays, sharing 5 of my favourite cultural or creative discoveries of the week. You'll find all that on lexonthedecks.substack.com. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy this episode of Hot Girls.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to Hot Girls with me, Lex on the Decks. This week, I'm joined by Shingy. Shingy rose to prominence as the lead singer and bassist for the Noisettes, and after a really incredible journey in that band, is now releasing music as a solo artist under her own label. She is the most magical spirit and an entertainer in every sense of the word. Through this conversation, we cover so many of the things which have influenced and shaped her career, from not being allowed to take music studies, being misunderstood as a black, non-classically trained musician, and also we talk about the importance of hearing different voices and the struggles in getting those heard. We also touch on the emotional challenges of being in a band and having not just a personal responsibility, but also that to your bandmates. Shingy is hilarious as well as insightful. If you enjoyed this conversation, please do give it a like or subscribe, or even better, tell a friend. Without further ado, Shingy on the Hot Girls podcast. Let's go.
Ladies, gentlemen,
listen up. You're listening to Hot Girls. With Lex on the Decks.
We in the mix.
It's fire.
Keep it going. We on fire.
From London for the world.
Let's go in.
A lot of people are being impacted by this in a lot of ways. And, you know, myself included, I've had some really dark moments here where I've seen some shadows of myself that I didn't even realise. You know, some things have come up from childhood and, like, trauma or other people's stuff. But what I am loving is just stuff like this. Me being on a podcast like this, so many people, you know, kind of podcasting, speaking out, like... And that's what I'm excited by.
It's so interesting as well, like what you're saying about just those shifts in conversation, because the process, and also one of the things that we try and do and or that we really enjoy doing on this podcast, is like having people who've had quite different career journeys and bringing those conversations together rather than it being a space where, I don't know, I feel like in a lot of spaces they focus very much on either people who are at the start of their career or people who are really have been in their career for 15 years. Yeah, it's almost like you've got the extremes. And
it's very dangerous to just hear from, as you said, certain people in society who are at certain stages, because when you cut out people who have like hit a stride and can actually share knowledge and information, maybe that's, you know, that should be embraced. Like people like yourself who have a really wide knowledge of like music and art and counterculture, and this should be huge, you know what I mean? But what seems to be huge is like people just want to hear about, I don't know, someone who's like 18 or 19 who's just, do you know what I mean, like trying to please and trying to be sexy and just, he loves me not. It's special times, you know, very special times, but there's a lot of great stuff happening. It's a great time to be an artist. It's an amazing time to be having the opportunity to, reevaluate what makes you authentic. Like, what is your voice? Like, who are you emulating? Like, who are you trying to be like? Or what are your creative goals?
Can I wind back right to the start of your musical journey? I was wondering, because did you go to Brit School?
Yes, Oh, you can tell, but I was in a drama department, so I don't know that many musicians that go to Brit, and I'm still to this day so pleasantly surprised by like how people go, oh, do you know that so-and-so went Brit school? Oh, babe, do you know this one went Brit school? And I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. The people in the drama department, anyone will tell you went to Brit school. We're like probably like the weirdos that people tend to
avoid. We're like in Mean Girls, the art freaks. That's
it. Yeah, exactly. Basically, that's what we are. We're like on the lawn doing our Stanislavski and doing a bit of Chekhov, trying to get into character, whereas the music people are all like, you know, with their rollies and stuff like that. So yeah,
how did you get there in the first? I mean, I remember when I was younger hearing that, like, a room, because I was a theatre kid, and I remember hearing
school
was a thing and being like, wow. Oh my God. But I grew up in the countryside, like so far away from London. So it was, and was that an amazing experience? It must have been fun.
It was, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, so I went from going to like, I went to quite like formal schools before, and I went to a convent for a minute. You know, I went to like an ex-grammar school for a minute. Yeah, I went to like quite formal, quite stiff schools before that, you know, where the uniform policy, yes, you have to be able to, yeah, get the test. But also, like, the second school, my secondary school before the Brit school, the policy was for the presentation policy, because it was like, you know, very sort of grammar school kind of rules, was that you were only allowed to wear a scrunchie that was red or black or navy blue, because those were part of the colours in our uniform, and your hair had to be able to tie back in a scrunchie. And I just remember, like, my mum and my aunties just laughing, going, have you ever seen a Southern African girl try to put that, you know, that beautiful mfushka rough hair in a hairband? Like, we've come a long way. Yeah, we've come a long way now. But yeah, so I had really sort of strict uniform, strict rules, very classical, which was fine by me, because I was like mad history buff, mad into English and, you know, creative stuff. But then when I said I was interested in like the arts, like really seriously, like music and drama, specifically theatre, they were very discouraging of that. Yeah, I kind of got a bit of a sense that it felt to them that, you know, culturally, theatre was for a certain kind of, you know, middle-class girl that plays the piano and looks a certain way and has actually playing an instrument since she was 4 or 5, so she needs to be... Basically, like, even if you wanted to do music GCSE, and when people opt for GCSEs, you'll usually start thinking about that at 13, 14. Like, you already had to be grade 5. And if you wanted to do certain subjects, you'd have to be grade 8. And I'm like, that would mean that, yeah, you would have to be playing an instrument since you were 5, 6 or 7. And obviously, that wasn't something that that was available to me formally, because we couldn't afford it. However, I had the most amazing amount of creative and musical talent, but they just couldn't see me as culturally sound to be able to study that strand as a GCSE. So I actually ended up going to Brit school, kind of in protest. I actually, when my mum went to bury my granddad, who passed away, yeah, when I was a teenager, and so she had to go back to Zimbabwe to bury him. And when she was away, I basically just went into, right, I know exactly what I want to do with my life. Like, my job is to uplift the universe. Like, I already knew my assignment before I got here. That's what I believe anyway. And so I was like, I need to get ready for my assignment. And, you know, like a lot of, I think there's a lot of pressure, especially for, like, you know, migrant children who are, you know, who have got, you know, African parents or very formal Caribbean parents or very formal Asian parents, that, you know, you've got to be like, you know, a lawyer, a doctor. Was it the Jeannie Asher? So she's like, there's 4 career options: lawyer, doctor, engineer, failure. It's like, right? It's
and you're like, what about number 5?
Yeah, how about, you know, black unicorn? Is that a career option, mum? How about Bantu, like ancient futuristic South London sonic rebel from the future? Can I do that as a job? Yeah, can I, you know, no, yeah, so I was too scared to basically really come out to my parents that, like, when my mum went away, we were looked after, you know, by, like, our aunts. So my siblings and I would stay at our aunts for most of, I think it was spring into summer holidays. So it was spring, maybe when you apply. I can't actually remember what it was, but all I know is that I stayed at my auntie's house, and she's absolutely, absolutely amazing, amazing woman. Did a lot of stuff high up in education, and really, really helped, you know, a lot of the community in South London in the way the education system was failing. Went, did the interview, really loved the place, fell in love with it, smashed the interview. I can't even remember. I think I can't even remember what I performed. Then I just basically, got her to persuaded her to charmed her into signing all the forms, did all the housework, did all my chores, every plate.
Was just an angel.
Was just an angel. And then literally when my mum got back from Zim, I was like, hey, mum. So, my mum found out that I'd taken myself out of the school that she worked so hard to, like, get us into, you know, and, like, somehow managed to get myself into Brit School, and just, you know, you just had to be a bit cunning. I couldn't mess it up because I'd already kind of told my other school kind of diplomatically where to
take there. But I just, the fact that you had that self-belief then is just so brilliant. I remember being told, I mean, different experiences and different, I guess I probably didn't have like such so many cultural things against me, but I do remember, I remember my music teacher telling my parents that I just didn't have them or something, and I kind of accepted some of those things, I think, and it took me quite a long time to not accept some of the things that now I look at and I'm like, you were wrong. I mean, you were just wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing how just like even a comment like that for, you know, a 13, 14, 15, 16 year old who should just feel like everything is possible. Everything is an available pathway. And when you talked about self-belief, you know, that's why we need to see more versions of people, because then all of these stories start to add up, and then we realize that they a lot of them are a lot more shared than we thought, but they just present in a different way, right?
Yes.
You know, and 100%. All of these microaggressions add up, and a lot of these microaggressions, you know, they do stem from often just a slightly misaligned, slightly darker root, which is just that, like, you know, people in education aren't given enough access to seeing testimony, seeing the talents of what different kids that look like, you know, can achieve. Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate what you said about the belief. But, and again, I think I even knew that, like, because I just learned music in a different way. So when you talk about rhythm, my mum used to put on loads of events and, you know, club nights with, you know, with my uncles. One of my uncles is Uncle Weller, and he used to put on these amazing music nights at this place called the Africa Center, which the original one was in Covent Garden. So, like, basically, like, in the 90s, like, all of the, some of the most amazing bands, African musicians would go through there, you know, like, from, I think, everyone from Fela Kuti to Hugh Masekela to Manu Dibango to, you know, all the greats have played there, right? And so there's a lot of musicians in my mum's family. So my mum's brother, Uncle Oswald, rest in power, he was an incredible drummer. And, you know, sadly, he passed away when I was a teenager as well. But whenever we used to go to Zimbabwe on holiday, he would always ask that I bring his favourite drumsticks from the local music shop down in Lewisham called Len Styles Music Shop. So I used to love going there as a kid. And that was like, that was my job. It was like, make sure we bring Uncle Oswald a pair of drumsticks back. There was another uncle called Uncle Alwis, who played with people like Hugh Masekela and, you know, Claude Depper, and he still plays a saxophone, so he might want some bits. And, you know, when people did come and do performances somewhere big, they would always do like their best. The performance at the Africa Center was always the one that had the most like African descendants who had just moved, you know, who were making new lives, right, in London or in England. In fact, people came from all over England to go to the Africa Center. It was such a staple. Yeah. Like, I mean, once you know, I mean, the story of that is probably like, you know, for other days, but I definitely highly recommend people, you know, looking into the story of some of the authors, some of the revolutionary activists and thinkers, you know, white, brown, across creeds, who used to meet there and literally like form the conversations which would then become the basis for revolutionary actions of those times, you know. And it was just one of these places, you know, where so many creative people came together and so many allies of those people were with them, and they were just, you know, art was just so much more reflective, I believe, and art was arguably had to be a lot braver because you didn't have the ease of social media to cut through. Like, you had to be original, OG, like, you had to have an authentic tone, you know, in the like late 80s, early 90s. And I remember they used to kind of, it was almost like the little Zim embassy or the little Southern African embassy in South London. So they might get taken out for a posh meal with their tour manager after. Like, for example, there's an incredible band called the Bunda Boys, who sadly, again, will rest in power. They're no longer with us. But they were huge in, you know, I think late 80s, early mid 90s, maybe. You know, they were championed by like proper OG DJs like John Peel. And that's why actually I feel like I had to almost be independent.
That's so interesting. And I think, imagine growing up around those kind of artists must have had a huge influence on what you then wanted to do as a songwriter and as a singer and the kind of music you wanted to release.
I can't be the child of like revolutionaries and just be like coming with some ABC. Like, I just can't, you know what I mean? It's like, and so what I had to do was with the Noisettes, I was so clever at making some of the most painful subjects sound like ABC. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is the craft of songwriting, of pop songwriting, that I embraced and loved, because I knew that if I wanted to recognize and appreciated and loved and respected as a musician and as an international artist, also as a young black female, I needed to make big songs. I needed to make big tunes. Like, Never Forget You is probably one of the happiest songs, you know, Don't Upset the Rhythm. But like, one day, Lex, we'll do the decode and you'll see that there's some moments in some of those Noisette songs where I'm singing about something else. You feel me, girl?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I had to be really good at metaphor, wordplay. My poetry was only sharpened by the oppressive experiences that I had. Because again, like I said, we've got to learn sometimes, you know, I had to learn how to upcycle all the negative stuff that happened, turn that SHIT into sugar. So then I realized around 2016, 17, when I was like literally reaching out to all of the independent labels. I don't even need to say their name because, the, everybody knows each other, whatever. Yeah. And those that passed, you know, they know who they are. And actually, I thank them. That's the best thing that my ancestors could have done, was just to say, do you know what, we're going to give you a ton of rejection emails after everything that you've achieved as a black girl, what with your natural hair, with your with your kind of, you know, inspiring, weird and wonderful, cosmic, Afrocentric, Afrofuturistic, you know, outfits from before. For you know, I was doing that at a time when it was very, very rare. So what happened is, you know, I just feel like, yeah, I mean, from sort of, you know, 2008 to like 2015, 16, we were just unstoppable. And then what you find is there's this beautiful moment of like, you know, 2012, 13, 14, and you get artists, amazing queens like Solange and, you know, Lizzo, and you start getting your Janelle Monáes coming through. And there's this wonderful, beautiful explosion of this renaissance of all of the things that I celebrated in my art, honestly and consistently from day one. Mm. But suddenly, the UK doesn't want to celebrate those vibes coming from me. They would rather groom and decide who it's going to be. So even if they've signed a singer that wants to be an R&B singer, they might, you know, put like, you know, sometimes what they might do is style that singer and develop them on other artists that have been successful. You know, we don't need to say any more, right? And so
They want to have a bit of ownership in that part of the story, whereas they couldn't do that with you because you'd already defined that for yourself. And I would also say, well, I was thinking when you're talking, it's the artistry and the visuals, but it's also the artistry in your music. I think one of the things that I found interesting when you're talking about being categorized and people essentially saying, you know, we're actually, we're done on our quota for brown girls, is like, Because your music has always, Too Bold, I find it, like, really want to hear about your creative process behind that and who you decided to work with and how you decided to, because your music's always been quite genre-defying, like, there's elements mm-hmm. of rock and roll in there. There's just a fusion of so many different things. And, you know, like, I want to know what instruments you worked with, what you brought in when you worked on Too Bold, how you decided that, because it really is music, but influenced by so many different things, which is why I find it, it's interesting that you still suffer that. Which box where are we going to put Shingy in? Like, if we've spoken to this person, then there's not space for that.
Yeah, I actually found it. Yeah, so that's a really beautiful, thank you so much for saying that. Like, I really appreciate it. It means a lot. It's making me sink into my feelings a bit, because, you know, again, I literally had to start from scratch. I mean, there's probably, you know, maybe there was a bit of advice here and there, which I'm very, very grateful for. But I'm really grateful for, you know, the creative community of female musicians. I have to give it up to the leaps and bounds that, you know, a lot of female musicians have been making, you know, over the last decade or so, and the ones that are coming through who have managed to appreciate just how important that self-authorship is, I won't even say self-ownership, because, you know, spiritually I believe that there's more, you know, at play, and that, you know, we are all connected to something greater and higher and just beautifully, incredibly wonderful, right? But if that's not your belief, then I would just say, yeah, there's definitely something really amazing that is happening. And I just kind of remember thinking that, you know, with all those sort of rejection emails or whatever it was, you know, I just revert back to whenever I'm in a position of, like, I don't know, I can't figure something out, I go back to that creativity. How do I adapt to this? You know, and if somebody says, oh, we're not signing an artist from this genre, I just don't try to make music that is in a genre. I endeavor and just make the music that I am, the sounds, the rhythms that attract me. You know, there's just so many things that have inspired me in the run-up to Too Bold. But essentially, if you wanted to know about the creative process and the journey, I'd say arguably Too Bold has probably been kicking since day one. I feel like that's, you know, if I imagine, of, you know, this is album number 4 for me, and for me, I definitely feel like it's my bravest record so far. I'm extremely proud of every Noisette's record and every collaboration I've done outside it, you know, known or unknown. But yeah, I just felt like there were just certain rhythms and melodies that came back to me from childhood. I grew up with this, like, juxtaposition of stories at home, and proud, you're the daughter of this, you're the son of that, you know, like, really, really warm, hardworking, like, excruciatingly, to fingers to the bone, hardworking, hard dancing, hard smiling, hard hugging, hard loving, flamboyant, headscarves, all the things, you know, and hard encouraging you to, you know, to get to know and to mix and blend and interact with your community, but remember who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I grew up with those. And so musically, that's already a part of my process that was already done. You know, I think a lot of people come into music now at different stages of their life. Not a lot of people get access to not just music lessons, but, like I said, which is what I was trying to say to my posh school that didn't think I could culturally do music. I had experience of hanging out with musicians every weekend with my family when they had gigs, and they, like, I didn't finish the story from earlier, but if they went out for dinner, like, if the Bundu Boys were taken out for dinner because they just did a tour with Madonna, which they did, they played Wembley Stadium, you know, with Madonna. And again, that's thanks to maverick visionaries like John Peel's. Like, it's very, very rare people like that right now. Like, he was the way that people talk about genres in radio, you know, especially at mainstream egalitarian radio. It's quite crazy considering that a lot of their trust and public confidence was built off the work of people like John Peel, who championed all music from all ages, all genres, all cultures. Like, he could, you know, do a DJ set on the radio at the crack of dawn or in the middle of the night that everybody would tune to, because you could hear Bunda Boys. And then you could hear Madonna if you wanted to play her. And then you could hear, you know, Talking Heads and Tina Weymouth, like, mashing it up on the bass. Then you could hear Paul Simon, and then he would go, but here's where this is from. And you'd hear, like, you know, then he would give you Ladysmith Black Mambazo or the Mahotella Queens. You feel me? So, like, musical lineage is maybe the poetic justice that I'm seeking subconsciously when I make music. That poetic justice I seek is that almost like, you know, there's been so much omission. And that's what I meant about in terms of, like, when I look back at Little Shing and how she used to call herself Cindy and shrink back in the class and shrink herself and hide and all this kind of stuff. You know, that omission sometimes is more dangerous than someone lying, you know, about popular culture and saying that the story of popular culture is just about the Beatles, and saying that popular culture is just about, you know, let's say 4 or 5 or, like, less than 10 white males. That's, like, that's next levels as well. You know what I'm saying? Like, that, what those very people do their best to celebrate where they get their inspiration from. You know, I've met Paul McCartney. He's an absolute freaking sweetheart. He was like, yeah, you know, here, take the bass, you know.
And you're trying to keep it?
He was like, you know, and we ended up jamming, we ended up making music. And then afterwards he was like, oh, you know, you've got something really beautiful. It's so pure, it's so raw, your musical energy. You know, you remind me of, like, Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, we had a song called Mr. Rosetta Tharpe, you know. And he was like, yeah.
Just a sort of practical or technical question. How long were you playing guitar, and do you play guitar as well as bass? And how long were you playing that before the Noisettes was formed and you started kind of performing with it?
So before Noisettes, like, me and Dan actually had quite a few bands together.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all with really terrible, awful names, thanks to yours truly. And so, yeah, he's a massive inspiration on me. Like, literally, he's like a big brother to me, you know? And like I said, there are so many elements, you know, within the kind of management. What can I say? There are so many elements in terms of what's the word I'm looking for? Like, the atmosphere of the band when you're not doing music, you know, like your setup, your format,
right,
your label. Yeah. There's so many people involved. And, you know, and over the last, you know, 10, 11 years, we had so many people involved that, you know, sometimes we didn't really get the chance to be able to just be those best friends that used to listen to records all the time. You know, sometimes management companies or, you know, financial advisors or, you know, partners, you know, we both had our fair share of people coming in and out and sort of going, oh yeah, well, she wants to make this, and, you know, oh, we don't want the, you know, the drummer and the guitar. But, you know, there's so many amazing dynamics that happen within the band. But musically, because he's such an incredible multi-instrumentalist, like, he plays so many different instruments, piano, keys, synths, guitar, vocals. So I was actually really inspired by him, but I had a guitar, I think, for about a year maximum before I met him. Maybe 6 months to a year I had a guitar. And then he really, really inspired me, and that was really beautiful.
You and Dan have done a few bands before the Noisettes was formed. Was there a kind of moment where you felt like you'd achieved what you wanted to achieve with the Noisettes, or where you decided you wanted to do your own project, or what was that process like?
Well, the process was really, I felt really held and supported creatively by that process, because it was gradual, you know. And as I said, like, because I was so lucky to have met Dan, like, you know, when I was probably like 16, he was probably like 18 or something.
Yeah.
18, 19 or something. So, I was so blessed by having that friendship from, like, basically, we're the kind of people who, like, will not accept, like, a dried, like, if he goes and does a guitar solo, and, like, he comes out and he knows, like, he could have gone in, but he kind of, like, do you know what I mean? Like, maybe just kept it safe.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need that, right? Sometimes you want to keep it suave, as long as that's what you're aiming for. But if you're aiming for this and you come back and you've got that look on your face, like, should I do another take, guys? We both know when we've still got the take in us, and we'll be like, do you know what, babes, that take's really great. Babes, oh my God, Don Jess, I'll wear it, because we've got so many different nicknames, which I'll be like, oh my God, that take is amazing. But should we just pop that take? We'll come back to it later. And just do another one for fun. Just don't even think about it. Or just, you know what? Let's go to the pub, or let's put the kettle on, or let's take a break. And maybe just do one where you're just not thinking about it too much. You know, so because I'm so blessed to have that history of like making music with amazing musicians and also amazing producers. But there was always something, I think, missing for me, in the sense that I felt like often when I walked into creative, you know, scenarios, unless it was like maybe with the actual musicians themselves, like there was a band called Solarfly that Dan and I had before, which was really cosmic, amazing band. It's almost like, you know, that was almost like the prototype really for Noisettes, the blueprint, if you like. That was like Lil Xing, kind of 16, 17, that kind of thing. Like even wilder than aspects of the Noisettes, arguably. So because I had experiences like that, I had the confidence and I had the musical versatility, and I already had a bit of experience because I was busking from when I was like 15, 16. Like, I was not going to wait to be trying to do that retail job when I've got spiky hair with bits of metal in it and I'm like listening to Hendrix really loud from my headphones, or like listening to Public Enemy, or like listening to Erykah Badu blasting through my little speaker on the basket on the front of my bike when I'm riding around South London. Once we really got into like the business of making records, you know, like the music industry, my God, we got this band, the Noisettes, you know, we were like signed to Motown. It was like so amazing. And, you know, we do all these like amazing like studio sessions and writing sessions. You want to work with this guy? Yeah, we're going to put you in the studio. We're going to put you in the plant, honey. You're going to love it there. It's up in Sausalito by the hills. It's really fresh. I mean, you know, Sly and Stone, they lived there for 10 years. It's got all the energies there. You know, you can do all your cosmic vocal stuff up there. Oh, no, we're going to take you to Sound City. Nirvana was there. So, you know, I know you're going to get your freak on or whatever. So, like, literally making the first album was an absolute dream. But what I found was that, like, there were so many writing sessions across the three albums that were quite negated by record companies. Right. And so, you know, when you're the artist, when you're, like, a female especially, now, obviously, things are definitely a lot more... Things are a lot more evolved, shall I say, in terms of, you know, how women are made to feel in the writing process, right, and in the creative process. For a lot of women who are creative might relate to this. You know, you go into a room and it's like full of, you know, really, really lovely, incredibly talented white guys, you know, between, you know, 25 and, you know, 55, 65 or whatever. And so, you know, you're there with them for maybe the whole day. Sometimes you're there with them for a 2 or 3 day session, you know, and on your way there, you've got butterflies, you're getting the tube, you're getting the bus, you're running late because, you know, you're helping the old lady cross the road, and then she turns out to be from some island in the Caribbean somewhere, or somewhere in Africa, or knows your auntie, and then you end up going, oh, you feel so bad, let me just walk you home with your groceries because this story is so juicy. And then you get there and you're an hour late, but you're like, oh, but I'm really, really glad that, you know, I helped Auntie with her bags and I got a great story. And then when you've left Auntie and or whoever it is, whatever it was that made you late, there's always some kind of story. Because I used to just get this burning, you know, kind of, and I still get it sometimes if I'm going to do a fresh session with people that I don't know. And this is what I wanted to not have on Too Bold. You know, this kind of, like, you get the butterflies in your tummy. What, you know, when am I going to be able to play them the riff that I had the idea for? I've got an idea. I've got my book. I've got my notebook of songs. Mm. You know, should I bring it with me? You know, when is the right moment going to be? You know, you're literally like almost petrified, but on the outside, because of, you know, that kind of slightly, you know, destructive code switching, black girl magic, whatever you want to call it. On the outside, you're like, yeah. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, let's try that. Yeah, so we were thinking, yeah, let's do something. I'm thinking bluesy, guys. What do you reckon? You know, oh, no, maybe sort of sexy. Okay, yeah, so, yeah, you know, you're seeing someone right now, and, you know, you start with the conversation, you're like, yeah, no, we were on tour, but we broke up. Oh, so what's that feel like? Okay, and then suddenly you're sort of writing songs. You're kind of almost, you have to be willing almost to be mined for your emotions, as in like a mine. You're not like mining. So you kind of, you have to be prepared to be emotionally and spiritually, arguably, mined and creatively mined. But also you're already someone that they're maybe not used to making music with someone like you very often. Do you feel me, right?
Yeah.
So you're in there and it's like you feel so lucky to be there. Oh my God, I'm working with, like, you know, I don't know what the David Copperfield or whatever it is of producers is today, you know, and the labels paying for the studio and, you know, there's so much pressure and we're going to make a hit and we have to make a hit. But really, you just want to plug in saying, excuse my French. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just need to get off your chest how you're feeling. Maybe, I'm sorry, I'm a little late. You know the stripes on it. Do you know what I mean? It's like some of those things will come out. Because sometimes they, without meaning to, they almost kind of feel like they want to be such a part of what you create and what you all write. But then you can't force the drill.
Force the honesty. And also, particularly because you're quite a spiritual person, I think it's like you're feeling something that's like authentically in and around you, probably better to have freedom to do that. But all of these kind of structured setups actually, like, with the best intentions, don't create that freedom.
Yeah, the freedom is important, but I think sometimes the most basic thing to remember is to create that safe, comfortable space where, do you know what, like, you know, I'm not going to be made to feel weird if I want to take my shoes. Like, that's what I'm saying. Things are getting better. But that's like, sometimes you want to take your shoes off, or you don't want to feel like you have to turn up with makeup, because you sing with makeup you is different to sing without makeup you. Because then you're kind of like singing more from Little Shin. You're singing about how Little Shin feels in that day, because you're not with your armor of makeup to cover your wonderful emotional battle scars that day. Yeah. And maybe you don't even want to go too deep into singing about the battle scars that day. Sometimes you just want to have a jam, but then they're like, you know, you're looking at the guitar and then obviously they're always the first one to pick it up. Like, how come they always know when you want to pick up when you want to, like, walk towards the scene, then you're like, oh wow, that's really, really cool. And this is what the guy producers do. Like, yeah, man, that's like a CS 80. Like 9,000. And then they, like, literally, all of them start having the most amazing jam and the most amazing time. They're like, yeah, man, listen to the oscillators. And you're just like, yeah, sounds so cool. Yeah, I love it. Oh, my God. And then, like, it's an hour later and you're still sort of sat there and, like, okay, you know that, you know, you were late and you were really nervous about if you were going to feel safe enough to be your authentic, weird and wonderful, soulful self in that music session. But then it's like they start making the music. They start putting down riffs and you're like, oh shit, okay, I'm never gonna be able to tell them, okay, we just go, I've got a lyric, I've got a poem that might go with, oh no, that was shit, that was written when I was a bit pissed, okay, and I'll skip that. Or maybe I'll go, maybe should I roll a joint? No, they're probably gonna judge me if I wanna get a little, do you know what I mean? It's like, the inner monologue is spiraling out of control and the guys are having the time of their life. They're like, you know, it's like, you know, they're going from, you know, prog rock into grime, because they already know they're working with Shindy, so they know that they've got to keep it interesting and versatile. Yeah. But there's just those male-female dynamics kicking, right? Yeah. Where, like, they forget that you play an instrument, or that you might like to have a little play on a synth, or that you might like to, and that's something that, you know, Dan was always amazing
at. They're literally performing at you, being like, yeah, you love this, and you're like,
and then check it, and then it's like, so, you know, you've got a top line to go on top of this, well, you know, what kind of melodies are coming to mind, and you're like, that's it, baby, yeah, let's get bluesy, let's get black, give me that vocal, like, I'm just like so many like microaggressions, or like there was so many, I think I just had about 10 years worth of like so many creative moments where I just didn't feel safe enough to fully express. Obviously with Dan, like I said, it was different, because, you know, what would sometimes end up happening at the end of a Noise X writing session is, you know, we would have that jam, or maybe with writing sessions for other artists, you know, they can be a bit more specific, they want this sound, or they even want to sound like a certain artist. And so I don't do those kind of sessions anymore, because I don't believe in advocating emulation. I never felt like I had to compromise ever writing songs with Dan, but whenever it was him and I, that went outside into bigger sessions, the dynamics were really, really tricky to navigate. You know, like he had to do a lot of being the supportive big brother to me, because he knew that, you know, you're going to be in a room full of bloke shing, and, you know, you're just going to have to speak up, woman. Do you know what I mean? Speak up, dear. You know,
yeah.
So I learned a lot from that. And then, you know, what also was crucial with Dan and I's relationship in terms of our creative journey is that we always had a massive respect for our parents' record collections and our family's relationship with music. So I told you that my family's huge, like, music creative presence. But Dan's dad, Uncle Bill, actually has played in some incredible bands and still plays music. So he plays harmonica, he sings, he's just absolutely incredibly beautiful soul. Uncle Bill, in fact. And so, you know, obviously I'm quite close to their family, you know, in my heart, in our hearts, we're very, very close. Like, they partially raised me and Dan, like my mum partially raised Dan. And, you know, Dan had Zimbabwean aunties and Jamaican uncles when he came round to mine, you know. So we used to really feed off each other's, like, you know, we'd almost try to sort of outdo each other. Like, who can find the weirdest record? Who can find the most rarest cut from this, this, I don't want to call them lost artists anymore. Let's call them omitted, the omitted ones, you know? We're going to call them the ones they try to omit. Mm. So Dan and I would be, you know, we were doing all that crate. I mean, now they call it crate digging or whatever, when it's not quite, people don't have access, I think, to the same physical levels as thrifting as they maybe did when I was a kid in the 90s. Like, you could actually physically go into, like, charity shops and find, like, hardcore gems. Like, I used to skip raid. Like, me and Dan's, you know, my first bass amp was, I found it in a skip outside Goldsmiths College, Goldsmiths University, because, you know, it was that point in the sort of, like, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s, when everybody was making a really rapid decision and a really, like, unthought through decision of, like, throwing out a lot of their good audio, SHIT, like, they're throwing out the sound system speakers and replacing them for these little, you know, crusty, made in, you know, factory made stuff. And, you know, the stuff that came from the more analog time of music was always made by hand. Often it was made with love, and it was made to last, like the cars, like the music, like the record, like the legacy of many of those musicians that we discussed, you know, when we first started the conversation, right? That you can't emulate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So then how did you actually get from that time that you spent with the Noisettes to Bold? What was the journey?
Yeah, when I think back to the cultural exchange that me and Dan had, it's like, I'm so grateful to have had that. And so, you know, in terms of, like, you know, how I got to Too Bold from Noisettes. So in 2013, you know, the Noisettes got to go to Haifa, which was widely unreported in the West, but it's fine because everybody knew about it in Africa. That's all the count. That's all that mattered at the time. So, we went to go and play this incredible festival called Haifa. And, you know, we played one of Thomas Mahomo's songs. So we had this beautiful, amazing house that we were renting with, like, a pool and, like, jacaranda trees. So we had this beautiful place. Mm. We had musicians coming in and out of the house, local musicians. So, like, mbira players, which is a type of thumb piano that we play. It's a bit like the kalimba. Mm. If you want to know what the kalimba is, just Google kalimba song, Earth, Wind and Fire. So it sounds a little bit similar to that, but the resonance is a lot bassier and a lot deeper. It's a bit more enchanting, I think I would say, arguably, because it can kind of put you in a trance, actually, if you listen to it too much. We played the Shlomba song, and the crowd, like, literally went, like, beautifully crazy. I was, like, climbing on the rafters, like, I think I had my bass, and I was like, it's amazing. That gig in Zim was a massive turning point for Noisettes. I've done festivals in places like that when I'm like, oh my God, how come I'm like one of only like three or four brown people here? I'm like, I'm in an, like, you know, I'm at a festival in Africa, you know, why is this not marketed to, you know, why isn't it marketed to people all over the world of different levels of income, right, of different backgrounds? Because it's just dope music, that's what's going on. Mm. Nothing else is going on. It's dope music and transformative experiences. Is there some agenda against people having dope music and transformative experiences that bring the collective closer together? you know, I don't know, you know.
It feels like that sometimes.
Sometimes it can. When you see the amount of resistance and pushback from the mainstream to like wonderful subcultures that are like, you know, again, inspiring the people that get positioned in the mainstream media. And then what happens is all of the people that are inspiring on the ground, got the like breathing the fire into the team, are written out the stories. And then you get sprinkles of what was really cool about that from, you know, the artists on top who don't appear to then actually have much freedom in the end or much creative happiness, even, I'd go as far as to say. You know, so, yeah, so Malawi was amazing. Zimbabwe was amazing. And we did, you know, just we did stuff like that. And whenever we'd go to somewhere like, you know, whenever we'd go somewhere like, we'd always get involved with a local musician, with a local artist. We went to my grandmother's village that I had not been to since I was 10 years old. If you're an artist who's had incredible commercial success, but you're starting again, but you're also a very unique and authentic artist, it's just a whole new roller coaster. So I'm actually really, really grateful that, you know, like, could Too Bold have come out on any other label but Zimtron? Could ask ourselves that? You know, where all of the I don't know, the name, you know, all of these lovely, well-meaning, you know, people that I'd worked with, your Jamies and your Quintons and your lovely, you know, Gareths, and were all these guys who I worked with before, would you know, I might have signed to them and I might have made the label, and then they might have been like, yeah, it's a bit too much, no pun intended. It's Too Bold, no pun intended.
Yeah,
it's, you know, imagine if that happened.
But
I probably would have that probably would have sent me onto a next level thing where maybe I would have thought, oh God, it's a pandemic. I spent two years writing this album for this, you know, really cool boutique looking independent label that, you know, I thought was really, really, really cool. And I thought was like really genuinely spirit led, authentic and progressive and reflective of who the game changing points of culture and who they've been and just all that kind of stuff. And I learned a lot that a lot of them aren't. You know, a lot of them are, you know, just lovely guys who are just doing what they love. It's their, you know, it's a hobby that they managed to make incredibly successful. They're crate diggers, they're music lovers, they're, you know, they're, you know, your guys that you went to public school or grammar school with. I've been out with guys like that, you know, so once you understand that and you don't take it personally, you go, do you know what, maybe this album, if it is going to be really the best and, you know, the culmination of everything that I've learned from, you know, arriving here on planet Earth and everything that I've achieved in the last decade of making brave out there pop music from the heart, then maybe that there's only one label that can come out on. Maybe it has to be you, babes. Like, I know it's going to be dry. I know there's going to be bare admin. I know it's going to, you know, present you with all these different truths and realities. That's what I was negotiating. Like every decision I made, I was like, okay, it has to make the band grow. It has to make the band big. It has to make the band successful. Not just because I knew that I possessed the talent and the inherent, you know, creative wealth in terms of ancestry as well. To be there and deserve to be there. And the study that it's taken, like I've studied my things, like, I live for this. It's my craft. Like, I respect it. Do you know what I'm saying? So what I kind of found is like, there were just times where I was like, I think sometimes I didn't make the right decision out of fear that, oh, any missed opportunity for the Noisettes. It's a missed opportunity from, you know, this kid from South London who I absolutely adore, like my big brother who I met, like he's got a dream as well. So I, you know, I can't be, you know, maybe I can't be too much like that, but maybe I can find my muchness. On stage is my office. You can never touch that ring. Like, I guard that place, and it has to be a place of pure love, energy, joy, just conjuring all the feels, all the good vibes. But Dan doesn't know that. You know, Dan doesn't know. Like, we still haven't even had the time to sit down and go, hey, babes, what's the deep roof? How is it for you? What was your relationship like with that manager at that time, or this manager, or that? Do you remember that time, you know, when, you know, I was, you know, late for rehearsal because, you know, the record label had put us all in this kind of like hotel room suite together, you know, on Sunset Boulevard, because, you know, maybe we didn't have that budget then where, you know, I was allowed to have my own room, even though I was a girl in a band. But I'm a black girl, like I've got heavy periods, I've got endometriosis crippling me with pain, but I'm going to back that Nurofen and get on stage. Like, he does, you know, they don't know all of these things.
Yeah. I've never thought about the emotional responsibility that you have, or that you would feel for bandmates as well and their success when you're really on that shared journey, particularly when, as you say, you were so close and you went through so much together. It's such a complicated thing because on the one hand, you're going on the same journey, but on the other hand, as you say, like, your emotional experiences, the way people respond to you as individuals, exactly the specific...
It's different to the way they respond to him, and it's different the way they responded to the drama. It's, you know, and that's something that we've never really... And that's another... Because you are made to feel like you do have to work times 10 times as harder as a black female up-and-coming artist, and you're lucky to be there. You know, it's what they don't say. It's the undertone. It's going in an office meeting, you know, and them going, well, you know, we're not going to necessarily pay like for the billboard campaign outside Westfield, which could maybe, you know, maybe if enough people drive around that freaking roundabout at like Shepherd's Bush, you know, when they see that billboard, chances are most people, they click and collect it. Do you know what I mean? They buy the thing, they download the album. So, but what we can do is we can give you Noisettes, because, you know, Shingy's not exactly the girl next door, is she? So what we'll give you guys a lovely little billboard. It's just on a corner of like Brick Lane and Old Street. Really, really up and coming, really cool. You know, it's where all the cool cats are. We'll give you a little billboard there, you know, for like a week. And then everyone
let's just see how it goes.
Yeah, let's see how it goes. Because, you know, I mean, Shing's not exactly the girl. You know, this is like the mystery. I felt like I was like, you know, that Black Beauty, that horse. You know, like the stallion that was like a bit of the wild card, you know, the office bear.
Wow, she's kind of amazing, but don't know.
But let's sign her so that no one else can have her. So she's not like a threat or any competition to any of our other artists.
Can I ask, we haven't spoken about it too much, but your voice to me is very special and very distinctive. Do you feel that, and do you hear that a lot? Do a lot of people comment when you're in interviews or in conversations and say, I know it's you when you sing? Not that that's a rare thing with a big artist, but like, your voice is very distinctive, I think, and very special. Do you feel that, and have you always felt that, or did you kind of teach yourself to sing, or what's that relationship like with you and your voice?
That's like such a beautiful question. That's a really nice question. That's the kind of questions you want to be asked, because it actually makes you genuinely think, where does my voice come from? So I think, yeah, it's something that for me, like your voice, it's like, I don't know, they say like, you know, your voice doesn't just come from here. Your voice comes from like your spirit. Your tone of your voice comes from maybe people in your family, experiences, kids, people you went to school with, people you grew up with. You know, it can be informed by the lingo, by the books you read, by the cartoons. You know, like, for example, there was something that really intrigued me recently, how I noticed a lot of my friends who are like having young kids, like little kids, they're beginning to talk these sort of, there's a bit of these American accents coming in. You know, like, I've got a really beautiful friend's son. I'm not going to say his name. He's like, yeah, cool. Oh, my God. Love you. Yeah. Ooh, yeah. And I feel like they are beginning to speak in the way that they are kind of marketed to with a lot of the American cartoons and the content that they digest. Because now a lot of, you know, parenting is so layered, and, you know, the challenges of parenthood are what they are right now. So some people just, at some point, they need to just give them a tablet, give them a phone, like, and they're one, or they're one and a half, or they're two. So they haven't even had the chance to develop their own voice, and they're already emulating the voice of, you know, what, that's why I said culture is so important. They're already emulating the voices and the accents of the cute, really, you know, lovely boys and girls that they see in cartoon characters, or animals that they see in cartoon characters, you know, coming from other places. And, you know, I really feel like the voice is more than just something that is reduced to a tool to communicate to get what you want. You know, the voice is not just about that. It's not just about, how do I ask for this? How do I demand this? So I use this tone. It can be an instrument. And I think because I grew up around so many different characters, and like larger than life characters, like not, you know, not like now, I feel like sometimes people are really trying to, in urban areas, people are trying to create these homogenized ways of speaking, you know, because it's really hard to figure out what unites us and what the common ground is now, because everyone's an individual on social media and they're not meeting up out and about in person, right? We're not, you know, the tribes of counterculture are really, really on the brink of extinction right now, but they're coming back. They're coming back. So what you find is that, you know, people are starting to develop these homogenous ways of like communicating that are kind of based on people that they like, or influences that they like, or as you are a kid, cartoons that they like. But for me, I was always attracted to unique voices because I grew up with characters that were larger than life. And also I grew up with characters who, even using their own voice in its authentic tone, could be weaponized against them. You know, if you were living in, like, you know, kind of colonial countries in Southern Africa, just, you had to small your voice. They, you know, a lot of them would have to small voice. That's what, I think that's what they say in Nigeria. They had to small their voice. I have nothing but praises to sing of the power of our voices, which is so untapped right now. And I would arguably say, especially in music, people don't feel, sorry, not all people, there is a lot of incredible breakthroughs and there's a lot of amazing people that are coming through and embracing, you know, aspects of their tone that weren't maybe considered as, you know, sexy or ladylike or girly or hot before. But there's also a lot of kind of conveyor belt pumped out almost identical voices which are emulating a certain type of voice, which is often usually very vulnerable. It's very kind of, it's like a vulnerable, but it's sexy. It's like, I can't even put it on, but I'm just detecting there's a lot of voices that are coming through in these beautiful new females that are coming through, which feels like, you know, there's, and I think it's important to embrace the vulnerability and the capabilities of the female voice. But what we all often also don't embrace about the capabilities of the female voice, and especially the Black female voice, is our spectrum of tone. And by spectrum of tone, I don't mean octaves in the operatic sense. I mean the texture, you know, like if something's pillowy, if something's velvety, like, and how that makes you feel when someone sings a certain note from a certain place. Is it coming from their chest? You know, is it, where is it? Is it coming from a place of pain and torture? Is it really high-pitched? Is it coming from a place of heartbreak? Or is it coming from a place of heartbreak? Like, freaking heart broken. Do you know what I mean? Like, why does every heartbreak song have to sound so sexy? Is that really what heartbreak is now? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I never heard of heartbreak sound. Maybe go in and get your heart broken, you know? Maybe something else broken. You know, I'm just like, yeah, I just feel there's still a lot more exploration and fun that can be done with women, especially having fun with their voices. And I don't want to do reverse sexism, but I say women just because the men have had so much fun and so much mainstream positioning.
Shingy, I could literally talk to you forever. Basically, want to keep in as much as possible of what we've covered because so much of it is so beautiful. And I do want to do the little marketing thing of just... Too Bold is obviously already out now on all streaming platforms. Where, other than kind of listening on normal platforms, do you have favourite social channels or spaces that people should kind of engage with you? Where can they find you online?
Yeah, at the moment I'm doing a lot of stuff on Insta. So Shingai, Sierra Hotel Indigo, November Golf Alpha Indigo.
Wow.
Because, babe, myself and the girl loves me a bit of that cabbie alphabet.
Like, I love it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why I just value my voice, because I grew up with like certified, like I said, larger than life characters, like the cabbies, like, you know, the Indian aunties, the Irish aunties, the Jamaican aunties, the Cockney auntie, like bumping into like Little Mo in East Street Market and nearly fainting because I was so in awe. I was like, you know, like, yeah. And I just really respect people who are, you know, allowing themselves to authentically embrace their culture and who they are and know how to harmonize it with others. It's not, maybe it isn't actually that deep, you know. So socially, I'm doing a lot of the campaign for Too Bold on Instagram, which I just spelled out. I'm just supporting a spectrum of people from the international community from around the world who are just doing really brave and wonderful things, even like in the most smallest random acts, right? So yeah, so you can find me on Instagram, on Twitter, The Book of Faces, and also The Book of Makeup. Yeah, you can find me there. After all that speaking about like marketing and reach, and you know, everyone's got to try and be authentic, I've also authentically got to remember that it's important to tell people if you do have stuff come out. And so yeah. I mentioned Too Bold, but I forgot to mention the video. So the video drops on International Women's Week. You know, forgive me if there's a couple of days delayed.
You know. Don't hold me. Yeah.
These are peak time. There's a pandemic, guys. Come on, there's peak time. There's a lot happening. And sometimes you have to just read the room, read the week, you know, don't try and force people to action things because they're often working from home as well. Yeah. And they've got people running around and, you know, like, you know, don't try and be like, you know, this is going to come out on this day and if not, I'm going to phone and harass.
I know,
Spotify
sometimes it's exhausting and you're like, okay, I can't. I got to get to bed now.
Right, yeah, so it's going to come out that week. The video is going to come out that week. And it's probably, yeah, the video that I'm most proud of today. It's an incredible collaboration with a director called Sheila Mortley, who is Ghana, UK. She's doing amazing things right now. I definitely would watch out for her. And, yeah, we shot it in South London, in Crystal Palace. It's just something that I'm really, really excited to unveil to you. Also because, you know, I said to you earlier in our conversation that, you know, I never grew up, I didn't see a video where there was like, I think it wasn't until like maybe like, was it late 90s? I don't know when this whole Brit, but I feel like I was still, do you know what I mean? I was still probably in like year seven or year eight or something when that whole thing, but I never seen girls in bands much until that point, unless, you know, like I said, unless it was like an uncle or someone playing me, you know, a Nina Simone record, she had an instrument, beautiful, unless it was like, you know, someone playing me Joni Mitchell, wow, that's inspiring, like I said, Joan Armatrade, Tracy Chapman, you know, but it was so rare to see groups of female musicians together, you know, where it was like, it was always a new, you know, lovely collaboration with Mick Jagger and Mick Jones and Mick, you know, all these lovely, you know, the Voice Club, right? They would always do their collaborations and it'd be like, you know, Lionel Richie doing a collaboration with, I don't know, like David Bowie. Like they always got to have that fun, like I said, right? They got to have that experimenting. And so I didn't see enough of that. So for the Too Bold video, I've got about 15 of some of the most incredible female musicians on the planet right now who have actually done a remix. We all did a remix together of the song Too Bold. And in the video, it's also featuring women from no less than, I think, four or five bands. And so the power...
That sounds
the
incredible.
Inspiration, you know, like what would it look like? I said, Sheila, you know, what would it look like to just have a video where you've got like the massive, you know, kind of Crystal Palace, you know, these amazing palatial steps that they have in the park. Imagine if all those steps had like, you know, like maybe like 10 female musicians, one with her drum kit there on the left. You've got Faye from Savages, do you know what I mean? With her drum kit, you know, 180 dB, amazing, you know, Extinction Rebellion, she's killing the game. Like, you've got, you know, the girls from the Tuts killing the ting. You've got Big Joni killing the ting. You've got Jenny Cleaver, mixed it, mastered by one of the mastering engineers at Strong Room, where you've got people like, you know, just amazing people. So I wanted to show people, it doesn't look that scary. It doesn't look that... you know, it's maybe it's revolutionary.
It's
in
fun action, as much as anything fun. Else.
Yeah. It's fun, you know, it's just great. And so literally I finally got the got to watch it, like the final version, because we're about to sort of submit and stuff this week. And I was just like, I just cried because I was like, wow, all you need to do is just be brave enough to invite people and make them feel like they are heard too. It's like, you know, you've got Nova Twins. They've got their podcast, Voices of the Unheard. And that's kind of what it felt like I was doing, bringing together a lot of voices and just amazing musicians, female musicians who do different things, not just singers. We don't just sing, we do other stuff as well. Not like there's anything just, like there's no such thing as just singing.
Yeah.
The vocal of the instrument that this is incredible. But so, yeah, I really wanted to mention that one before I go, just because I'm really, really proud of it and because it's the hot girl podcast.
Yeah, so, I'm so glad you did.
That's my tribute, that's my gift. That's my, I don't know, that's just like my, yeah, that's my offering to, you know, all female musicians and allies of musicians and artists that identify as female, right? So that is for you guys, you know, like you maybe after that, we won't have to do so many interviews and podcasts like this, because maybe the next generation of, you know, up and coming journalists will look at that video and they'll get a better sense of what we're doing, who we are, you know, because we've made something that's not me doing whatever I'm expected to do in the video. I'm like, no, let's use this space to like put all of the 100% that we all give individually. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that's 1,500%. Do you know what I mean? So I wanted to leave you with that.
Check it out. It sounds so magical. Thank
you. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. And
I'm so glad. I'm so glad we could get you on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Have a magical day and week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Shout out to everybody that you big up. Shout out to yourselves for doing this. Hopefully can't wait to meet you in person.
I know. That would be
amazing. See
lovely.
You at the show, right? See you at the gig. What up, Lex?
Surprise, good women were destined to rise. Yeah. Inspiring, celebrating, uplifting the new generation. Some hot girls, you know the vibe. Yeah. All the hot girls come alive. All the hot girls, you know the vibe. All my hot girls come alive. Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.